Today is Friday, April 19th. It's 11:13 in the morning. Hi, I'm John Williams, and this is The Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio in Chicago. Listen for me weekdays from 1 to 3, Steve Bertrand.
I'm the host of the Wintrust Business Lunch Monday through Friday on WGN Radio.
I host my own little show on Monday through Friday from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m., and I'm Patty Vasquez.
Why are you making that face? You just made a sideways smile.
I'm just watching this, some video
of what?
Something you asked me to have an opinion about.
We're here for dinner. Put the phone down
and
talk to your parents.
Is it the video of Tim Anderson?
Yes, it is.
Getting the home run and then getting hit. We'll get to that. First, 448 pages later, and 2 years in, we now have the Mueller report. What's the matter now?
Nothing.
Okay.
I mean, it's all wrong, but go ahead.
The report's all wrong?
I think the report is all... You know, the thing is, the report strikes me as being about what we thought it was going to be.
Here's the thing. And, you know, Donald Trump talks about the fake press, right? The enemies of the people. He's declared the press the enemies. They saved his hide, I think.
His staff.
The press. There's an interesting theory out there that because enterprising reporters, we knew most of this stuff. You know, it had been reported over the past 2 years.
Oh, yeah, right.
Had none of that been reported and it all dropped yesterday, he'd be fighting for his life.
The New York Times said, just imagine if this came with a clean slate, if you didn't know anything and you experienced the totality of this all at once.
Which is an impossibility.
Well, no, but it's not
because
impossibility.
Because of vigorous reporting.
Had it not been reported.
Well, right. And also the way he handled his staff and their reaction to it and their desire to want to leak it.
No, but this point, I think, is that since we were sort of getting drip, drip, drip of this,
right.
It's the Steve Bertrand thing all over again. It's like you're so used to it, you don't even notice how bad it is. And if you drop it all on a 500-page report, which they did, and you had just handed it to somebody and say, okay, this,
right.
And they didn't know anything about it, they'd go, oh, that's got to stop right now.
It was like watching the season review of Game of Thrones before the next season started. we already watched all this.
Yeah. Well, in part, I mean, the expectation, at least early on, was, oh, my God, look at this story. Can you believe this is happening? And you expect that the American public will be like, well, this is outrageous.
Well,
but as you've mentioned time and time again, he's made this craziness normal.
The president today tweeting that it's all bullshit.
Oh, boy.
Or at least that some of it is.
Those are his words. He's still mad at the Mueller report, even though he likes to say it exonerated him with the Game of Thrones meme, by the way. But listen, I wrote a paragraph, so let me read it.
Okay, sorry.
I'll stand down.
2 years later, we have the Mueller report. The first news, tell me if you agree with this, is that the report did not find that any American colluded with Russia. Not the president, not his campaign, not even Chicago's very own George Papadopoulos. Obviously, several Americans did commit crimes and told lies about their activities. But coordinate with Russia? No. The second news is that it wasn't for not trying. They just couldn't pull it off.
It's a gang that can't shoot straight.
The president could not get his staff to carry out his orders that would have greatly changed this story. A friend of ours tweeted to me right when the report came out, and he said, okay, whatever. But the president does not like to be seen as anything but all powerful. And this is clearly a report about how he would have shot himself in the foot, but he couldn't get his staff to follow through with his directives. The report details instances, too, where the president and Sarah Sanders and others did not speak the truth.
She lied.
The report details several instances where media reports were true, but that the president labeled them false. So when he would say, I did not talk to or I did not ask somebody to do X. In fact, Mueller wasn't in the room. But the conclusion of the Mueller report is that the president continued to lie about his activities and his communication. So that was my paragraph.
So Sarah Sanders said on two occasions, right, 2 days in a row after the Comey firing, that she'd heard from countless FBI agents.
On May 3rd, Sean came out and said the president has full confidence in his FBI director. Why did he say that?
Look, I think, again, he's questioned Director Comey's reason for needing to stay at the FBI. He had countless conversations with members from within the FBI.
Who wanted Comey out. I think one time she said it was a slip of the tongue, and then another time she said it was something she said in the heat of the moment.
Yep.
That I had a slip of the tongue when I used the word countless, but it's not untrue, and certainly you just echoed exactly the sentiment and the point that I was making, is that a number of both current and former FBI agents agreed with the president.
Which is just ridiculous. She lied. She's a liar. That's proven now by her own testimony.
She said that what she was doing was, those were not prepared remarks. Today.
So right. What? Well, today's Friday. I didn't prepare that remark.
These are not prepared lies. These are made up lies on the spot.
In the heat of the moment, she said, and now she's, you know, so pick the version of it you want. But I'll tell you what she says about what you just said about what she said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is that it is true. She had heard from, she didn't know everybody in the FBI, but a lot of the FBI people she heard from didn't like James Comey. Final answer.
She's the White House press secretary. She lives in the heat of the moment.
Yeah.
The moment heats up when she wakes up. To quote the president, a bullshit excuse.
Mm-hmm. And if your go-to is to lie immediately, that just undermines everything else anyway.
Well, it just showed to me.
I'm trying to make sure this conversation does not get played on your Saturday show.
Well, but I mean, it just is a reminder, and Bill Barr was evidence of this too, where I think they confused their personal allegiance with their responsibility, right? So she was just throwing stuff out there to help Donald Trump and maybe herself, even though in the back of her mind, she knew that this was padding. This was not true. But this is what you do when your boss is getting attacked.
I mean, look, every White House press secretary's job is to, unlike the attorney general, is to work directly for the president and to convey his message or his thoughts. And so she is more, she should be considered more of an advocate for the president than the attorney general should be. But that doesn't excuse lying directly to the American people. And I'm sorry, her idea that this was said in the heat of the moment or contentious, that's not a slip of the tongue. And it's just kind of pathetic that rather than, I don't know, she would never acknowledge it, but rather than sort of acquiesce and move on, she doubles down and says, well, at least I wasn't like the Democrats.
Oh, boy.
Well, then Monday morning quarterback Bill Barr's performance for him, too.
Oh, geez, that too. I mean, his job is not to be the attorney for the President of the United States.
He was sounding like Rudy Giuliani, wasn't
he? Yeah, let that guy come out.
There was, in fact, no collusion. And as the special counsel's report acknowledges, there is substantial evidence to show that the president was frustrated and angered by his sincere belief that the investigation was undermining his presidency, propelled by his political opponents and fueled by illegal leaks.
It's, you know, we talked about this last week. It's very discouraging because he was supposed to be one of the adults, you know, and when he used the word spy in his testimony before Congress last week or the week before, I was very discouraged by that. And now he's proven himself to his characterization of the Mueller report was not accurate. And that's just, it's sad because he should be above that.
It's weird because he and Mueller are friends or have been friendly over the years. One of them attended the wedding of the other's daughter and stuff like that. I guess it's a small circle they all travel in. But at the press conference prior to the release of it, he really was trying to explain the excuses, missteps, and lies of the president the way Rudy Giuliani would. And not only did I think that his interpretation of it isn't necessary, right? We've already got that. If you said Sarah Sanders, Donald Trump, Robert Mueller, Bill Barr, who climbed down the ladder the most, I would say it was Mr. Barr.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, him saying that, well, yeah, the president tried to obstruct justice, but his political enemies were, he felt like they were out to get him. Well, that's what political enemies do. You know,
deal with it. You're the president of the
exactly.
United States.
I mean, what did Mitch McConnell say the day Barack Obama was inaugurated? Our job is to make sure he doesn't get reelected. For Barr to also say that he didn't find obstruction of justice because the president didn't mean to break the law. That wouldn't fly for you or me.
No.
Maybe Patty.
Well, and if you say that you're plotting to murder somebody and you don't murder them, you're still in a lot of hot water for plotting it.
You're in hot water. But, you know, the report said that there was no criminal activity here. I think it was a real.
Did the report say that? No, not about obstruction, I don't think.
No criminal charges have been filed against the president of the campaign.
But well, because it was Mueller's view that he couldn't do that, so he presented the evidence, didn't draw a conclusion. Left it for the Congress.
And in part because he couldn't bring charges, Trump wouldn't be able to go into court to refute them. Then that's part of the reason why he didn't bring charges. He's leaving it up to Congress.
Which is frustrating to me how narrowly then Mueller took his responsibility. I mean, this is vast and they did a lot. But wouldn't it have been nice if he had been a little more strident for those of us who want to see the president get kicked in the butt?
Well, you know, the president famously said he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it.
They say, I have the most loyal people. Did you ever see that? Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible.
And I think now he could. If we can't charge a president, which is where we are, which I think needs to be revisited somehow, if we can't charge a president and the House won't impeach the president if the Senate's not guaranteed to convict him, then he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. I don't have the solution to it. I understand the difficulties in charging a sitting president, but it seems like we need to revisit that somehow. I mean, it seems like if the president is in office because of laws that he broke during the campaign,
right,
he should, and I don't even mean this specific president, although he's a perfect example, that there should be a mechanism short, because if the Congress isn't going to impeach them, isn't for partisan reasons, then there should be an alternative somehow.
Well, I think the alternative comes in 2 years.
But
I
mean, it's only a rule. It's not in the Constitution. It's not a law that you can't indict a sitting president. It's just sort of a Justice Department understanding.
We don't think about this much, but you really do need to think about it. What's more important to you, that a president breaks the law and gets away with it, or that 300 million people vote for president and they decide this is going to be their guy and they want him to lead the country and they don't care if he has a parking ticket or if he lied to you, they want him to be president? That's gigantic. So if he is put in jail, he's not able to execute what the people have assigned him to do. I mean, listen, books are being written about this right now. I happen to have read one of them. And that's the logic of why you don't charge or put in jail,
right,
say, a sitting president.
But if the president is acting in a corrupt manner, in an illegal manner, or a manner...
Here's what Mueller wrote. His conclusion that Congress may apply the obstruction laws to the president's corrupt exercise of the powers of office accords with our constitutional system of checks and balance and the principle that no person is above the law. He's leaving it up to Congress.
Who wrote that?
This is Mueller.
Yeah, but see, Congress, the Republican Senate,
they're not
going to
do it.
Is not going to vote to remove him. So the Democratic House, and I understand that, they say, why should we go through with this?
Those Republicans really have just teeny little testicles, don't they?
Wow.
But I think that everything's calculated, and they've determined that that will, in fact, play for them when they want to get reelected.
Again,
right,
going back to what the New York Times said, had all of this come out for the very first time yesterday, the Republicans might have swayed differently.
The last thing I just want you to consider, though, is what I think is really – so I said the first story is that no American committed any crime of coordinating with the Russians, right? Papadopoulos went to jail, stuff like that. But the Mueller report after 2 years and all of the resources they put into this could not find anybody to charge with, quote unquote, colluding with Russia.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, I haven't read the whole thing, so, and I don't know enough about it. But it's weird to me because they also said that the campaign knew full well when the WikiLeaks dumps were coming, right?
Yes, sure. They were alerted by the Trove farm.
But he goes into what he would have constituted a crime. And it has to be action coordinated by information received from the other, right? So if WikiLeaks did that and Trump's team knew that, what did Trump do about that? Or did they hand the documents to them? No, right? So the fact that they knew or even wanted to be more...
Right, they wanted to benefit from it.
Yeah, there was cooperation, but not conspiracy.
Maybe that's the distinction. But
or awareness.
Listen, so as important as that is, and it really is, I saw the report as a delineation of how vast the intrusion was into the election process, how coordinated the effort was, social media campaigns. You know, some of those fake websites or Facebook accounts, Twitter accounts, Instagram accounts, some of them had hundreds of thousands of followers. And some of the things that these Russians then were putting out, like Hillary's bad or Donald Trump is good, you know, fill in the blanks, were being retweeted by Kellyanne Conway, by Donald Trump, by Donald Trump Jr., by Michael Flynn Jr., who was, you know, willing to just run with any nutty thing. But you got a real sense of how woven in to the fabric of the political scene they were. And that's one thing. And then that's the social media thing. And then the other thing was the hacking that they did of the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign. And I don't know, if this report wasn't about Donald Trump, I think it's meritorious based on what they discovered about the intrusion into the election.
And how pliable Americans are when they read something that they want to believe.
You know, I got one last thing about that, Patty. I was thinking about that. So some of these Russians would say, using DC Leaks or Guccifer 2,
right,
or maybe just Joe Blow, they would say, hey, let's have a rally in front of Trump Tower or in Florida or South Carolina. And then maybe nobody would show up, but maybe somebody would. And so I wonder if it's all that terrible what the Russians were doing. That is, they said, let's have a rally. But Americans showed up. People who like Donald Trump would show up at the rally.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't Russians at the rally. It was Americans at the rally.
But they were fanning flames. I mean, they were, you know, bringing light to the embers.
Yeah, right.
Well, and spreading lies. And again, people, no one wants to admit that they've been tricked. But there you are.
Where do we go from here, John?
Yeah, really?
Well, we leave Illinois. People are leaving the state. Newly released census data shows that no state saw greater population loss than Illinois. Every major population center in this state lost people. And Cook County experienced the largest county population loss in the country. Why are people leaving Illinois in such numbers?
A lot of people are talking about property taxes. And I was talking to someone yesterday about how badly we're doing with higher education and retaining students here. When people go to school in other states, they tend to stay there. I mean, that's a smaller part of that percentage. But
I think we're doing better when it comes to that, especially in the tech industry, tech world, the STEM educations. The numbers show that people are starting to stay around Illinois.
They think that University of Illinois is down by 8%. There was a meeting at Maine Township, and Senator Murphy said that there was not a single student going to the University of Illinois from Maine. The one in Park, I think, in Park Ridge, across from Lutheran General.
Mm.
So
I mean, that's surprising.
So why? But I got to tell you, I don't understand.
That she met. I'm not sure if that's the whole class.
Yeah.
But of all the students that were in the room, not a single was going to the University of Illinois.
I moved from Minneapolis to Chicago. So I live in Chicago, in Cook County, in Illinois. I'm an outlier here.
How do you like it?
I like it.
Right,
I like it. And by the way, my taxes are not high compared to the suburbs. I understand
it's
people
like
leaving.
That's a funny thing to me.
What?
What?
I agree with you. The city residents who complain about their property taxes
are paying $7,800 or $5,300. Mm-hmm. What are you paying up in?
Well, I'm paying. I'm not going to tell you what I'm paying, but I'm paying a lot less than my neighbors because my neighbors have all rebuilt. So they're paying $20,000, over $20,000 a year.
Wow.
That's cuckoo bananas. A guy called in to our show yesterday. So we were on the stream. We were just, while the White Sox were on the radio, we still do our shows at WGNradio.com. But when we do that, if I say, hey, why, whatever, I'm not talking on the radio to Chicagoans. I have a disproportionate people who are listening to me out of state because that's the only way they can get it. Fine. So I said, why did you leave Illinois?
Mm-hmm.
Or why do you know somebody's leaving Illinois? Guy called in from Arkansas. He said, I lived in Elgin. It was a fine little neighborhood. You know, it's not the Gold Coast, but Elgin's a fine place to raise a family. He was happy with the schools. He was paying about $7,500 or $8,000 a year in property taxes. His taxes in Arkansas, he uses his credit card. They're about $600.
A year?
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Is he like Arkansas?
Enough.
So I don't understand that because what else is happening in Arkansas? I mean, are they must be funding schools in a different way or funding.
Right.
You know,
happens. So then your sales taxes are higher. Something's got to make up. Some schools there aren't so good either.
You're right. And some of the lower tax states truly are lower. They are doing it with fewer tax dollars. But I just don't think it's that dramatic sometimes because the money's got to be coming from somewhere.
Well, a lady also texted us. A woman in Texas wrote, she said, so she left Chicago for all these kinds of reasons too. She says, so I'm in Texas. It is boring here. I mean,
well, you get what you pay for sometimes, well, although I don't know
I think. I think these people that leave in a huff will say these things, mm-hmm. but it's not the reason they're leaving, right? Like they say, I'm tired of Madigan. Find the person who left the state of Illinois.
Because of Speaker Madigan.
Right.
Right. You know. And that's a foolish decision. I mean, hopefully they had smarter, better reasons to go.
Right. I know, because they've got their version of that there. Maybe not as bad.
But I think you're right. They might find themselves out for one reason. But the fact is, if more people are leaving Illinois than any other state,
they're leaving it for some reason.
Yeah.
And it is largely economic. So the Illinois Policy Institute chief economist came on. Why did you make that sound?
Well, they're apparently a non-for-profit, but they seem to have a lot of one profit and a lot of opinions on things when it's not necessarily their role to do that.
What's their bias?
Their bias is conservative. Very conservative.
Yeah, right. So they don't like taxes. And
well,
I don't.
Well, most people don't either. But
yeah, I know that. But, if you're J.B. Pritzker, you got to say, well, all right, what am I going to do? He said this week, name the service you want cut by 15%. Do you want 15% fewer state police? 15% fewer potholes fixed? 15% fewer teachers or less pay for teachers? Tell me what
care
you want to
cut. Care for the elderly?
Right, I know. Right. So what do you want to – so we're going to have to raise taxes. And the Illinois Policy Institute says that just drives people, business, and the rich away. You want to tax the rich more, they'll be gone. Although here again, I don't know the rich person, except maybe Tiger Woods, who said, I'm not going to live there anymore because the taxes are too high. Does that happen?
Phil Mickelson did it. I think he left California for Florida.
They go to Florida because there's no state income tax there. So, and that's gigantic if you're a gigantic wage earner. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I know some people who are in the top 20% of wages. And well, I don't know anybody that's left because they hate the taxes, but they're still paying $20,000 a year on their house, and they shrug it off. So what am I saying here? I'm still asking the question, why do people leave? And maybe I'm answering my own question, right? Maybe it is that. It's just the economics.
Right. It's seductive to go somewhere where, like you just said, there's no income tax in Florida, but they also have a bigger tourism tax base, I mean, and revenue.
I don't know. I get real defensive about this. I get real boostery. I'm like, come on, everybody.
If they want to go, you can't make them stay.
I know that.
Some of them will say it's for weather, too.
The weather they've got. I get that.
Yeah, but so if you said, okay, I'm going to go to Phoenix or Tucson, forget that. Uh-uh. I mean, do you want 106?
Well, okay, Arkansas, right? The guy
tornadoes.
Arkansas. No, but Arkansas is much more
humidity.
Separate. Also Arkansas.
But the point I'm trying to make.
And Arkansas.
People aren't moving out. I mean, pick a low-tax northern state. People aren't moving to Montana, right? They're moving. Right. When we hear about people moving, they're moving south.
Yeah, they're not going to North Dakota.
So there's your probably a big part of your reason.
All right, so give me the 1, 2, 3. I won't hold you to this, but reasons people leave Illinois. Go.
Weather. Cost of living. Mm-hmm. And political climate.
That's probably Chicago mm-hmm. you're talking about there.
I would say the same. Yeah.
You know, I think there's no way to gauge the burden.
Well, you just asked us the question. What is your answer?
Weather.
Something different than ours.
Cost of living mm-hmm. and the Cubs.
Wow.
Start to win more games. I'm out of here.
Oh, boy.
I want to talk about the White Sox, actually, for a second. So Tim Anderson was up Wednesday against the Kansas City Royals, hit a really big home run.
Tim crushes this ball. He throws the bat. The ball goes flying. It is gone. 2-0 Sox.
It was one of those ones. There was no doubt about it. And the White Sox are under 500, and they'll probably finish that way. But they've been playing good ball. They had won 3 or 4, 4 or 5. And he was, like, jacked up when he hit this big home run. And Anderson has been hitting just under 500. He's like top three in Major League Baseball for most hitting statistics. And he just jettisoned the bat over towards the dugout. Comes off as a bat flip. The other pitcher didn't like it. His next at bat, they hit him right in the butt.
And Maldonado gets right in Anderson's face after Keller drills him with the first pitch. And here we go.
And then both benches empty and the managers got into a fight. Anderson was thrown out, which was the biggest crime, according to some, because he really didn't do anything wrong. He took a step towards the mound, but he didn't charge. I guess my question is, what do you make of that unwritten rule in baseball that if you show up the pitcher, you celebrate, you get hit?
You mean if you hurt someone's feelings?
Right.
I mean, that's what it is. It's like, well, you hurt our feelings, and so now we're going to hurt your butt. Right? I mean, that's essentially what we're talking about. And yet I still kind of like the fact that the players police each other and expect certain behavior. So I think, what did Anderson say about being plunked? He probably wasn't very surprised.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I don't know how you do that. You come up the next at bat and you're stepping into a fastball.
Right.
Because that's your job, but you're pretty sure it's going to come at your body and you will not get out of the way. And it'll be 92 miles an hour.
Exactly. And you're taking a chance. Both of them are taking a chance.
That's the thing. When you consider what they invest in players. And so Kevin Powell, one of our sports guys here, he's terrific. He's kind of on board. He likes that part of the game. And he said, you know, he hit him in a meaty part of his body, butt cheek.
Yeah, but I mean, up
your
higher,
head.
What if he gets him in the ribs? I mean, now you've got
well,
a crack.
Well, that's it. What if he hit him in the elbow?
Right. I mean,
My nephew hit a home run against another Big Ten team.
I saw the video. Go Minnesota.
Gophers.
He tries this one. Deep out to left field. What a rocket off the bat of Easton Bertrand to get back a run.
Then he went in the dugout, stuck his tongue out, did a little act for the cameras. But he got plunked two more times in that series.
What?
So
was he leaning into the pitch?
Well, I asked him, and he doesn't think it was retaliation. But the point is, he got hit in the wrist and has a fairly significant injury now
right.
because of it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's playing, but so He said he was leaning into the pitch. It wasn't retaliation.
But, you know, when I – so I'm offering that up, that when you consider what they pay the players, think about how just bad this is for the sport. If teams start to lose their marquee talent, nobody benefits from that, right? And yet I can't think of a single instance where a hit-by-pitch actually cost a team or a player many days' worth of duty, right? You know, as you listen to this, you may know of a player, but generally that's that just does not happen much.
I don't have time to do the research.
But one other thing about that, just think about it. In football, if you score a touchdown, you can do an end zone dance.
Right.
In hockey, if you score a goal, you can do that slide with the double clutch. You can do that. Now, the NBA doesn't really give you enough time because you got to run the other way after your slam dunk. So you can, you know, strike a pose, but you got to get going.
You can run with your three in the air. You know?
Right, exactly. Soccer, it's choreographed. The NFL, frankly, those dances are choreographed now. They all play roles. They all, okay, oh my God, we scored. And then they all run over and do the little skit.
Silly.
The other teams don't retaliate for that celebration, but for some reason, baseball just cannot have it.
They're more sensitive. You don't want to hurt their feelings.
The somberness, now it sounds like.
I'm not sure how important the staffing issues are at Kim Fox's office. I'm not really even sure that we need to pay any more attention to the fallout from the Jussie Smollett thing, but we are.
Well, those texts are outrageous.
Did you think so?
Well, I was listening to you talking about it and playing back some of her interview where she was saying, you know,
I was not involved in the arrangement. I had recused myself.
The Tribune and everybody else thinks they've got her in a lie now because they got her emails and her text messages to come forward. And they say it conflicts with what she said, that she recused herself, that she was not involved in the execution of that case. Was she lying?
You could use that word. I mean, you can't. She said you're either recused or you're unrecused, right? And then while she was quote unquote recused, she was commenting on the severity of the charges.
She said that they didn't need to, that 16 counts was too much.
Too much in texting. And so that's wrong.
But that's all she said.
That's all she said in the text that we've seen.
Okay. Well, all right. Maybe there's more stuff I'll change. People do
still talk person to person.
She said she didn't do that.
Well, she said she was recused, too.
Okay. But so all they have is this one text where she says it'll be Exhibit A if they say this is overreach because R. Kelly just gets a handful of counts and he's a pedophile. And then we get 16 counts against Jussie Smollett.
Which is a very good point. I don't disagree with her point that for what this guy did, maybe 16 counts was over
prosecution. I wouldn't contrast it with the R. Kelly stuff.
Okay, but still, for what this guy did, 16 felony counts, you know, that might be an overreach. I don't necessarily disagree with her, but okay. You can't say I've recused myself and then have that conversation.
Right. Well, and I also, it wasn't in the messages that she was, they were surprised at how much the backlash was from the press, from social media worldwide.
Yes, they were not prepared, and they did indicate. And it was also telling, I thought, how they were mocking and belittling Rahm Emanuel, because there he was, remember, giving that press conference with Eddie Johnson after the charges were dropped. They were kind of blindsided, and it was at a police
graduation ceremony,
the largest police academy class ever. In fact, one of the texts from Kim Fox to one of her deputies or vice versa had LOL there. Like, oh boy, they're there with all the cops and this is dropping LOL. I'm thinking LO nothing.
Oh boy.
You know, you big dummies, you don't think this is going to blow up on you? How do you not have a plan in place? How do you not execute it better? But if they didn't have that one text where she said that compared to R. Kelly, we are overstepping. I don't think they have a front page story in the Tribune.
But they have that text.
Yep, that's all
and,
you need.
And this is it, right?
It's like if Anderson doesn't throw his bat, you know, well, he doesn't get thrown out of the game.
This is all you need to do if you're the boss. You open the door and say, I'm not happy. And then you close the door. If that's the only communication you have, that could ripple for days. That maybe is all you need to say to unrecuse yourself. Right. I mean, that must be the case here. I just thought there'd be more evidence that she was more intimately involved in the handling of the case than there wasn't. Notre Dame almost burned to the ground. The bell towers were saved. Some of the stained glass windows were saved. The superstructure is saved. Their moonshot in France is to now have in 5 years that thing rebuilt by their Olympics. It's going to take hundreds of millions of dollars, and hundreds of millions of dollars have been already privately donated. I want to tell you what an argument is they're having in France now. Should they restore Notre Dame brick by brick as it was, or should they modernize it and put a 21st century flair to it, whatever that means?
I don't know if they need flair, but maybe better plumbing, I'm guessing. I don't know.
Due to it with the reconstituted Wrigley Field.
Yeah.
You know, keep the, it'll still look like it from the outside, but more toilets.
Well, don't Soldier Field it and land a spaceship on it. You know?
Well, that's a very good difference, right? So I think the integrity of Wrigley Field, the ballpark, has been largely maintained. Say what you want about the buildings in the neighborhood, but Wrigley Field from the outside still looks like Wrigley Field when you drive by.
From the outside.
From the outside.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, we decided we could live with the scoreboard. We decided we could live with the lights. I think people are happy with the changes made inside Wrigley Field.
No, but I mean, I think probably everyone's agreed the outside of Notre Dame will be restored the way it was. But it is about the inside.
Oh, is that what this debate is about?
I think so.
Well, you've got that spire. What are they going to do with the spire? Are they going to build the spire back exactly, or do they want to do something different? I'm not saying put a cell tower there, although this is a real revenue opportunity for them, and I wouldn't say no right away. Wouldn't it be terrible if it had a dish on the top of the thing? So they're arguing about should it be exactly as it was, or should we grow? Should we evolve?
See, I thought that was more about an interior question, which I could be more acceptable than. I think the exterior, you've got to stay true. That's the way I would do it. Interior is an interesting discussion. I don't know about that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the materials, you have to decide what you're going to do in that sense.
But, you know, they rebuilt it in the 1800s, right?
Yeah. Well, that's...
And he wanted to stay true to the origin, and that's why there was timber in there. By that time, they might have used more steel, but he was saying, well, that's not the way it was done.
Yeah, I would rethink that one.
But I would also say that to me at least supports the case of evolving it. I mean, it was built 800 or 900 years ago. It has had numerous desecrations and rebuilds anyway, so you don't have the original as it is. The White House burned to the ground once upon a time, so I'm okay with the evolution of these buildings. So here come then the Patty, are you up to speed on the last 30 seconds? Now we're going to go, the clock will tick for 30 seconds. You get one last chance to say one last thing you want to say.
I think of what I want to say. Yeah. It's a lot of pressure.
All right, I'll go.
Okay, go ahead.
In 3, 2, 1, woof.
I've been watching a show on Netflix, a Ricky Gervais show. It's called Afterlife. And Ricky Gervais is one of those guys, I don't think I've talked about this yet, who is can be a real hit or miss. But when he's a hit, when he's got the right material, he's dead on. And he plays a guy, he's behind the show, wrote it and everything, who recently lost his wife. He's desperate, or he's despairing, I should say. So he doesn't care about anything. It's very funny. He writes for a local newspaper in England. It's called Afterlife, and he comes around toward the end.
You ready, Patty?
I think so. Let me get my stopwatch. Go. Bye.
Bye, Steve Bertrand.
Bye.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go.
My son is 15 years old, my older son, Griffin, and I have been spending a lot of time with him. I find that I'm very protective of when we can, you know, watch movies or talk about politics, because I only have 3 more years left before he goes off to college. And I realize now that I wish along the way I had realized when the last time would be the last time I would pick him up from the crib, maybe even the last time I changed his diaper, last time he would hold my hand, because I tried to reach over and hold his hand the other day, and he wouldn't let me, and I can't remember when the last time was.
Yeah, welcome to parenthood.
I know.
He's 15.
Yeah.
Lucky you had it till 15.
But we were watching the movies last summer, and I remember he let me hold his hand, and I was like, oh, he still lets me do that in this year. Not so much.
But you must be kind of happy about that, too.
Yeah. No, I know. He's a teenager. He gets to flick my hand away. He flicked my hand away, John.
My 30 seconds go like this. The other day, we talked to Marvin Sussman on my show. He is 95. He was at Normandy on D-Day. In fact, he was there 2 hours before the troops to secure an island just off the beach. The podcast is on my Facebook page and on my station page at WGNradio.com. We cannot appreciate what those guys went through and did. And he is still able to tell his stories. Look for Marvin Sussman on YouTube and our podcast. Patty Vasquez, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Steve Bertrand, thanks for coming in. Eric Zorn, sorry you are sick. Scott Stantis, sorry you couldn't join us. Justin Kaufman, sorry you couldn't join us.
Quite the list.
But I'm glad we were here. We're produced by Elif Garris. I saw Bob Ferguson on the other side of the glass. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.